Pleased to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. And we're starting our show today by taking a look at a lifetime of research about wolves on Isle Royale National Park. You know, for about a half century now, Michigan's Isle Royale National Park has been the site of a very comprehensive study on wolves. It's the world's longest-running study on any wild animal, as a matter of fact. The island itself, it's about 200 square miles, about 20 miles from Ontario, and it has lush northern landscape and wolf and moose populations. It's a pristine and isolated park, and it presents an ideal laboratory for wildlife biologists. And the wildlife biologist who's done the most there is Rolf Peterson, and he's our guest today with us by phone to talk about his book, The Wolves of Isle Royale, A Broken Balance. I'm really pleased to have him with us today. And certainly, if you have questions as we move along, I'm sure you will, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Rolf Peterson, as I said, with us by phone. Rolf, hi. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to be here.
This book was originally published by Willow Creek Press back in 1995. Did you originally come to Isle Royale as a grad student, by the way?
Yep, in 1970. I was a grad student of Durward Allen, who was at Purdue University at the time, and he started the work in 1958 at Purdue.
At Purdue. And what were your duties on Isle Royale?
Oh, to extend the wolf moose research another 3-4 years and find something new.
I can see if there's something new going on. Well, as I said, the book was originally published in 1995 and it was updated this past year. And what brought on the revision?
Well, the original print run was out of print and it was no longer available, and there was still demand for the book, so University of Michigan Press took it on and brought it out again.
Yeah.
In paperback this time.
Yeah, in paperback this time, and it's really beautiful. Obviously, you're a great photographer. Some wonderful photography in the book along with the story, but let's tell that story a little bit. When did the wolves first show up on the island? After all, it's an island.
Yeah, it's about 60 years ago. The current population appears to have been founded in the late 40s. And we know now from genetic work that there's just been one female that produced all the offspring that currently inhabit the island. And I guess two males are involved, and we're just trying to track that down when those males showed up with DNA from bones.
Oh, man. So
it's a very inbred population.
Very inbred population, and probably if a person's going to speculate, it was probably a pair.
Oh, yeah, probably a pair
that made it across on the ice to the island.
Yeah, and they found a moose population that was without predation and ripe for them to go to work on, and they did.
And they did. And what again was the size of the moose population at that time?
Well, we don't really know it, but it had been as high as maybe 3,000 or so in 1929, 1930. But then there was a big die-off in 1934, but there was a huge forest fire in 1936 that renewed the forest growth. So, hundreds of moose, but we really don't have a very good solid figure.
Yeah, and you mentioned the drop. There was a sizable drop in wolf herd numbers on the island in the early 1980s.
Yeah, 1981, in the 50-year history, the biggest hit was the arrival of parvovirus in 1981, and came with a...
Oop, are you there? Oh, I think we lost him. We have temporarily lost Rolf Peterson. I'll tell you what, we will get back in touch with him in just a second. I'm pretty sure of that. In the meantime, no callers online, so if you want to join in with your questions, we're talking about the wolves of Isle Royale, of course, but if you've got some questions about wolf behavior and some of the findings, I know there's a lot of interesting findings from the research. Gosh, 50 years of research. I hope you'll join in with your questions. And again, I'll give you the number. It's 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890. And, of course, you can email us as well at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm just taking a look at the book itself. As I mentioned, the photography in the book is absolutely amazing. There are many, many, many shots of wolves that are overkills. There are many shots of chase shots. There are shots of other animals as well. I guess there's a beautiful shot of a picture of a red fox, which was taken at midnight at the bunkhouse door in the winter, and the bunkhouse door was open, and the fox is looking into the door. It's a beautiful piece of photography. And there are also some other kind of cool pictures, too. There's a shot in one case of a calf and a frustrated cow moose. The calf was on ice, standing on glare ice, and was frightened and wouldn't move. And Don Glazer kind of looked it over and inspected the scene. The moose stayed there for 24 hours and finally moved after a fresh snowfall fell on the ice and was able to, get its traction. And Rolf, are you back? Not quite back yet. Okay, so Jim Packard's working on that. So that's one of the photos I really find striking, because he's standing within a few feet of that mother and her little one, who's looks pretty scared out there. And I think the other thing that I like about the tracks. There are some aerial photos, quite a bit of aerial photos that in the snow following the tracks of the pack and near a kill. And you get a sort of a pictorial. You find out what happened. You can follow the tracks and actually see how the wolves themselves kind of came in from different angles and surrounded the moose and took over. So I think that's another beautiful, beautiful picture in here. But there are also lots of great pictures that you're going to find of the other animals as well, the moose and so forth. Here's a kind of a sad one of a dead male wolf hauled out of an old copper mine shaft. And it was it had just died of old age and malnutrition. And so there's a lot of great photography in here, but there's also a lot of really good writing in here as well about the ecology of the island itself, about the relationship between the wolves and the moose. Is obviously a pretty close relationship, and I expect that in some ways the wolf population has helped the moose population. It's possible, and I want to find that out as we visit with him. But we're really having some trouble getting to him, and I'm hoping we're going to be able to do that not too long. I'm finding out that we're not getting some ring. So, he's calling from northern Michigan, and the line up there, it should be okay. There's no cell phone, so we can't, there's no cell phone service up in that area of the country, so we weren't able to do that. So he had to drive into a spot, I think, in Michigan to make his call to us. And somewhere along the line, the line went dead, and we're not having any luck at all getting him on. And I'm really, really sorry for that, because He's got a great, great story to tell. It's he himself is obviously a wildlife biologist, and there are over 100 photos that he took, most of them. He's known worldwide for his wolf research, and his photographs have been published in places like National Geographic and Audubon and National Wildlife. He's actually a professor of wildlife ecology at Michigan Technological University. So he has had a wonderful career. I mean, can you imagine coming to a place like that in the 70s and then pretty much spending your career really going into depth and really studying wolves and their behavior. So I've been hoping we'd be able to get him, but it looks like we may not have him. I'm really sorry for that. We're not getting a ring on his end, so of the line. But maybe he will call back. Maybe we'll be able to get him at some point. But for now, unfortunately, Tanya, we're not going to be able to get him on, I don't think. Tonya?
Oh, hi.
Hi. I'm really sorry that we're not going to be able to get him on at the moment. And I bet you had a good question for him, too. I'm sorry. But we had a lot of other callers online, too. But you know what we do when we have a situation like this? We turn to other topics, and usually what happens in a situation like this, when we lose a guest and we've lost the whole thing, we will often turn to talking about other things. Trish has a story, and Trish, I don't know, maybe we'll get you on here. Trish, are you there?
I sure am. Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Well, I just thought I'd call while we're waiting for your guest to come back, because I had an amazing experience with wolves in the Lamar Valley of Yellowstone National Park.
This is Tricia McConnell, by the way. Patricia, thanks for calling. Tell us about that story. It's a great story.
Oh, it was so wonderful. I encourage people to visit there if they possibly can. It's the only place in the country where you have a very good chance of seeing wild wolves in person. So we were driving down this little highway in the Lamar Valley and saw some people with scopes who seemed to be looking at something. So we stopped, and indeed they'd found a pair of wolves that were on the other side of a river. And these two wolves would howl, and then they'd stop for a little bit, and then they'd trot forward maybe 50 yards, and then they'd stop, and then they'd howl. So you can imagine this beautiful scene, this beautiful valley with the mist coming off a river, and these two wolves, one gray, one black, howling with their heads up into the air. And then all of a sudden, we heard what sounded like more howling. Somebody said, "That's more than two wolves." And we turned around, Larry, and behind us on a cliff, like out of a Walt Disney movie, there were five wolves silhouetted on a cliff.
Oh, man.
Right behind us. And we watched the two move, oh, maybe a third of a mile across the river, across the road, and join up with the pack. And we watched the pack go through their greeting ritual. I will confess, I had tears coming out of my eyes. It was amazing. So even though I love that we have a healthy wolf population in Wisconsin, you're probably not going to see it, you know?
Yeah.
I just wanted to encourage people to try and get out to Yellowstone if they could.
Patricia, thank you. Thanks very much for calling and sharing that story, Patricia McConnell. She and I do a lots of work together, especially and you'll hear us on Saturdays on Calling All Pets. And it's an amazing story to share on wolves. Larry Mueller here. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You know, Patricia McConnell just mentioned and told that amazing story of wolves in Yellowstone. It is an amazing story. And I don't think most of us have not had a chance to see wolves. I've got a story to tell about that as well. But I want to go to Susan in Bessemer, Michigan, who has a point to share with us. Hi, Susan.
Hi, I'm glad to be on your show this morning. I listen to it every day.
Thank you.
the point I wanted to make was we were out there last summer, kind of a precursor to hiking on the Appalachian Trail. We went out there to do some hiking. And we went to a ranger program. And when Dr. Peterson was cut off, he was talking about the parvovirus.
Yes.
And at that program, they told us that it was introduced in the island because someone brought a dog on the island.
Oh, you're kidding.
And so I guess the point I want to make is that we have to be so very careful in these pristine environments because what we do really does affect that area. And so I guess that's just what I wanted to talk about because, you know, you say you had this wonderful laboratory there and then somebody introduced something into it that, you know, kind of goofed up everything that they were doing out there. So.
It's really too sad, really sad. And it, as you say, it points out how, you know, something that seems kind of innocent, okay, we'll take our dog. And the dog probably wasn't there all that long, but it was there long enough to create a problem with parvovirus. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, we're so lucky to have that environment out there. I mean, you have to make an effort to get there, you know. It's not like you can just drive your car out there.
Yeah.
It's nice if people can just respect what the people out there, you know, have and what they want to do with that area.
Yeah.
And not bring bad things into the area.
Yeah, I agree with you very much. And I think we're good. I think we've got, and thanks for that call, Susan. I think we've got Rolf Peterson back with us. And Rolf, are you there?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
All right. We lost you, but we're glad to have you back.
Good. Works.
Well, I tell you what. We were talking about the book a little bit while you were off, or while we were trying to reach you, and the wonderful things. But talk about the relationship between the wolves and the moose on that island. Is it a relationship that works for both animals in some ways? It certainly would seem to be the case.
Oh, yeah. And in a very real sense, the wolf culls that moose population and keeps the whole herd in a growing, productive situation. They're in better health, certainly. They're actually getting larger over time because wolves are calling out the small ones at any age group, particularly when they're still growing as young adults. So, without wolves, their moose would be probably existing at a much higher level. There'd be much more malnutrition. The animals themselves would be getting smaller on their way to becoming miniatures, which is what happens when they don't have large carnivores.
Yeah. How did you, now you came, you said in the 70s, and you pretty much, you've spent your career studying the wolves there.
Yep, 38 years so far.
That's got to be an amazing, that almost has to be a record in and of itself.
Oh, I don't know. You got Jane Goodall out there who's been working with chimps for longer than that. But the whole Isle Royale study started a couple of years before Jane Goodall went to Africa.
Yeah, well, I tell you, I'm not even sure how to wrap my mind around this in terms of questions for you, but what are some of the most striking things that you've learned that have been learned in studying the relationship between the wolves and the moose over the time that you've been there?
Well, probably the most compelling single thing when you look at the whole 50-year time series of wolf and moose fluctuations is that any 10-year period or even a 5-year period taken out of that series would give you a very definite answer of what, you know, what the relationship was between wolves and moose at that time. You know, wolves are clobbering the moose, or wolves weren't having any effect at all, and you'd come away with a definite answer. And it would be wrong for the long haul. So things have changed. You know, every 10-year period is unique all by itself. And so when you put it all together, you realize, gosh, things change over time rather dramatically.
One of the things I noticed in the book was the fact that you can get fairly close to some of these animals, or a lot of these animals. And I just wonder I guess my question is, to what extent does this ongoing study over such a long period of time, do you think it's had an effect on sort of the natural way that the wolves and the moose and the other animals relate to each other?
Oh, I don't think so. They certainly know what people are all about, and they know in the summer there's lots of us around, and they actually take advantage of us. You know, cow moose with calves tend to seek out people because they can be safer from wolves if they're near people. In the winter, you know, it's just a small research crew there, and we're in an airplane most of the time. And the wolves know we're in that airplane, and they know we can't hurt them. And they treat us sort of like a big raven.
So you're minding your own business, so to speak, and so they just go ahead and mind their own business.
Yeah, although they seem to know that we're tracking wolves, because there has been one time in particular that it was quite clear a wolf used our plane to find the rest of its pack.
Oh.
And that was quite a startling revelation for me.
Now,
I didn't think they were paying any attention to what we were doing.
Now, how did that happen?
Oh, it was just, you know, wolves, most of the wolves had left this kill, and there was one wolf left feeding on it, and we were going back and forth between the kill where the lone wolf was and where the pack had gone to. And there was no snow. The wolves weren't leaving tracks, and when the lone wolf left the pack, he started going the wrong direction and then saw us circling over where the rest of the pack was, and he made an abrupt turn and went at an angle right for the pack.
Pretty interesting. David in Ashland has a question or comment. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Rolf, this is Dave Vandermeel, and a former student of yours from Michigan Tech.
Oh, sure, yeah. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Just calling to ask if you wouldn't mind telling folks about your moose bone collection and the condition of the bones and how that relates to what moose the wolves are going after on the island. And I'll take comments off the air.
All right. Thanks, David.
Yeah, we've got certainly the largest collection of moose bones in the world, and pieces from over 4,000 moose. So we've used those right along since the very beginning of the study to figure out, first of all, how old are the moose that wolves kill, and they tend to be either calves born less than a year before or old moose 10 years old or older. And those old moose have lots of pathology, arthritis, osteoporosis, periodontal disease, and that gets worse as they get older. So that was an early finding from back in the 60s. But then we've used those bones to go back and look at other things. We've recently discovered moose have been getting bigger, and that just comes from measuring the length of their metatarsal bone. And we've used the elements that are stored in moose teeth. When those teeth are formed, they incorporate all the air and elements around them. So we've looked at lead and mercury declines in moose teeth and radioactive carbon from the atom bomb tests of the 50s and 60s. Now we're going back to those same moose bones to extract DNA to see what the genetic characteristics of that moose population have been like over time. So it's been a very useful collection.
Oh, man, it must have been. You mentioned that the wolves all sort of came from one female, essentially, and a couple of males. And I'm wondering about inbreeding. I mean, it's obviously inbreeding, and what that effect has had on the wolf population.
We know that over half of them have an extra vertebrae in their lower back, extra lumbar vertebrae, and that's probably an effect of inbreeding. That's 10 times higher than any other wolf population anywhere in the world. But, you know, the wolves with extra vertebrae often are the oldest, most successful wolves in the population. So they've lived 10, 12 years, reproduced many times, so they're the winners in the crowd. And so the extra vertebrae doesn't seem to be a problem. And actually 5% of people have an extra vertebrae, too. Usually don't know it.
So. Usually don't know it.
But, you know, if there was a more serious problem produced by by inbreeding, they wouldn't survive. You know, those animals are they die right away. So there's strong natural selection for survival in that population, and there always has been. So that may be part of the reason that we haven't seen a real effect of inbreeding.
Was there ever a time when anybody was tempted, the researchers were tempted to, say, bring in some fresh stock in terms of wolves?
Well, when I first wrote that book in the early 90s or mid-90s, I thought the wolves had maybe a 50-50 chance of survival because they were really at a low level and not reproducing very well. And at that point, we discovered they were highly inbred. So it looked pretty bleak. And I thought we should at least discuss, you know, publicly what would happen if they went extinct. And that's why I wrote the book. But they didn't go extinct. So that discussion never really happened. So actually, the scientific value of letting that population go is very high because scientists are already surprised that they've survived this long in spite of inbreeding. So scientists are learning something pretty useful about how natural populations might survive even though they're at a very, very low level. So when you find most scientists are wrong about something, it's real important to to pursue that.
To keep that going, you bet. And we'll take some more calls. By the way, you can join us at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Give us a call or send us an email. We'll be glad to get you on the air. And we're joined by Joe in Chippewa Falls. So let's go to Joe next and see what's on Joe's mind. Hi, Joe.
Hey, Larry. Look, I love your shows you have on here.
Thank you.
Actually, Ralph, I have a lot of your work in my den, some of your pictures already.
Good.
I'm just curious. Your place up there in Upper Michigan, do they take visitors to be able to see what's going on? Because I visited Ely up in northern Minnesota, and also there's a place in Keystone, South Dakota, where they initially raised the pups. Wolf pups to get them into certain areas in the country. And I've got such a fondness for wolves, and I'm wondering if there is actually, do you allow people to come up there and see that?
Oh, of course, the Isle Royale is a national park, and so it's open all from April through November for visitors. And actually, our summer field camp, which is on Rock Harbor at the east end of Isle Royale, is visited by over 1,000 people a year or so. They come to see the bones and hear about wolves and moose, and so yeah, you're more than welcome.
And do you have a kind of run a program, Rolf? Then for people who do come to the island, yeah, it sounds like you give talks.
Well, I often give talks at Rock Harbor Lodge, interpretive talks in the evening, but people drop in at all times of the day, and they're more than welcome. So yeah, just very informal at our summer base camp.
Yeah,
and so sometimes we're not there, but the bones are still there.
Yeah, the bones are still there, and you know that brings to mind the fact that we've got four seasons: we got spring, summer, winter, fall, and winter. And I'm wondering about the research before we go back to the phones here. How your research changes, or what's your research? What does a research year look like for you folks?
Well, the winter work is done from an airplane, and so we're just victims of whatever weather we have, and almost everything we do relies on being able to fly. Summertime, it's all on the ground. So, yeah, it's very different. But at all times of the year, we're looking for carcasses or skeletons of moose. And in the winter, of course, we're focused on wolves, counting wolves, following their tracks, to find kills, and counting the moose as well.
Dana in Neillsville has a question or comment. Hi, Dana.
Oh, I was calling about as far as in northern Wisconsin, the wolf population is getting up higher. Would there be any point where you would think that it would be necessary to have a hunting season on wolves if the population ever got high enough?
Well, wolves in northern Wisconsin and upper Michigan have been increasing steadily for the last 15 years. And I know in Upper Michigan, they're not at the level which they would naturally level off. And I suspect that may be true in northern Wisconsin, too, because there's deer density is very, very high. Could you control it through hunting? It would have to be pretty serious hunting at a level that probably the public wouldn't tolerate, I suspect. So, you know, these wolves in northern Wisconsin, Michigan are still on their way to reaching equilibrium with deer, and deer are very, very numerous. So I think they haven't topped out yet. Now, whether the spread of wolves into southern Wisconsin or the overall increase will be tolerated or is tolerable, that's a situation that residents of each state will have to determine. And, you know, we're just starting that process.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wouldn't hit the alarm button just because wolves are now on the ground. Society is still functioning pretty well. And it makes northern Wisconsin and upper Michigan a very different kind of place for a lot of people.
Yeah. Thanks, Dana. Zach and Mercer, it's your turn. Hi, Zach.
Hello. My question has to do with climate change. I know Minnesota has some fairly new research out on climate effects on moose. I'm wondering if you've seen anything, any changes with your moose and wolf populations to deal with climate change.
Mm.
Yeah, I think it's actually the biggest thing to happen to moose in the last 10 years because in that time, beginning in 1998, which was an extremely warm year, biggest El Nino year in this part of the world, moose have been in sort of a steady decline, and now they're at near the lowest point we've seen them. And it's clear now that moose at the southern end of the range in North America are handicapped by warm summers. They can't feed, and they can't put on enough fat to survive the winter. And then as winters are easier, deer have moved farther north, and deer carry three nasty parasites that moose can't handle very well. And so moose are dying of energy shortage coupled with the energy drain of these deer parasites. So it's a tough situation for moose, and Minnesota is very worried. I mean, moose have disappeared from northwestern Minnesota, and they seem to be not doing that well in northeastern Minnesota. And I think I'd put Isle Royale moose in the same basket.
No, thanks, Zach. Kate in Fox Cities, your turn. Hi, Kate.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question was regarding the wolf population and the study having revealed that it seems to have originated from an original pair. Does your study indicate that at various times additional wolves may have gotten to the island and added to the population?
Genetic evidence would suggest that if other wolves did come, they never reproduced. And we saw it happen once when black wolves came over in 1967, and one of them remained behind the next year, and he eventually became dominant male in a pack, but he died apparently without ever reproducing.
Oh, okay.
So we still don't know when that second male showed up, but we will eventually know by just looking at DNA from bones of wolves that we have for the last 50 years. But yeah, it's surprising that no other breeders have shown up, but they would meet a fairly hostile group of resident wolves. So
right. Okay.
The wolves that are on Isle Royale, they feel they own their territory, and they usually don't want any help.
Right, thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Well, that also brings to mind the moose themselves, how the moose got there, and are they all descended from one mom?
Yeah, we're hoping to answer that question by going after DNA in their bones now. We don't really have any details about how they got there. We know it was roughly in the early 1900s sometime, and we just presume that they swam because they don't like walking on ice. And there's no evidence that, you know, there's always a rumor that somebody put them there, and that's true for any time an animal shows up someplace new. But we haven't seen the evidence of that, so... We think they just swam over there, and it may have been a fairly small number of founders. But they had the advantage genetically of increasing very quickly, so all the genetic variation that was in those founders was probably preserved. And then their numbers are high enough so that most of the genetic variation should have been passed down from generation to generation. But there would have been a founder effect of those very first few individuals. And there's some interesting questions, especially involving arthritis, in these moose that may have a genetic origin. Very high rates of arthritis in old moose.
In old moose. Well, what do you think, what if the wolves on Isle Royale become extinct, or, well, if the moose become extinct, the wolves are going to become extinct too, probably.
Well, the moose probably won't become extinct, but wolves, you know, every time moose hit a low level, wolves are going to hit a low level a few years later.
Yeah.
And and wolves are so much closer to zero that when they go down, just random chance could extinguish them. So moose are probably going to hang on, but whenever moose are at a low ebb, wolves are going to be there shortly, and they may not be able to handle it. And then if the whole average moose density declines due to, you know, warmer climates, then, you know, it may not be a sustainable system for long-term wolf survival.
You think if the Isle Royale wolves became extinct, do you think the Park Service should replace them?
Well, it would be a more complicated question than it was 15 years ago,
yeah,
when, you know, it was a disease issue,
right,
that really brought them to low levels. Now, you know, there'd be more evidence that it's a kind of a global human effect. But I think, you know, we'd have to go through the whole exercise of deliberation and public review and so forth. But I would tend to advocate keeping wolves there, even if they had to be put out there every few decades or so.
Yeah. Well, Ralph, it's a pleasure to have spoken with you. I've really enjoyed your book, and I appreciate you taking the time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Well, thank you very much, Larry. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you. Ralph Peterson is the author of the book, The Wolves of Isle Royale, A Broken Balance. It was first published, as we said, back in 1995, and then re-upped and republished and out again. And some beautiful photography, along with some great writing about what goes on at Isle Royale between the wolves and the moose, and a little bit the people, too. Appreciate having him with us. The Wolves of Isle Royale. Well, coming up, we're going to take a look at grilling and barbecuing and spit roasting. And we'll be looking at a little different this time around. We'll be looking at grass-fed meat. And that's a different kind of animal, so to speak. As we talk with Shannon Hayes, who is the author of the Grass-Fed Gourmet Cookbook, and her new cookbook is called The Farmer and the Grill, A Guide to Grilling, Barbecuing, and Spit Roasting Grass-Fed Meat, and For Saving the Planet, One Bite at a Time. I kind of like that. That's a long title, but I kind of like that title. And we'll be visiting with Shannon Hayes coming up next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.